Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. What a wonderful thing for Laker fans to wake up this morning knowing that the Lakers have their 17th NBA title. Winning Game 6 last night in the bubble in Orlando, LeBron James and Anthony Davis leading a very talented and defensively resilient team to the NBA championship under quite extraordinary circumstances. Coming up next hour, we'll talk about the Lakers, and I'll ask listeners to share where they think this Laker team compares to some of the Laker greats of years gone by. We celebrate the Lakers' NBA title coming up in the 11 o'clock hour of Air Talk right here on KPCC. Right now, the Senate Judiciary Committee confirmation hearing is going on for Judge Amy Coney Barrett. Right now, the senators are giving their opening statements, alternating by party. Earlier this morning, California's Dianne Feinstein, who's the ranking Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, focused on health care and the future of the Affordable Care Act.
Judge Barrett, you've been critical of Chief Justice Roberts for his 5-4 opinion upholding the law, stating that Roberts, quote, pushed the Affordable Care Act beyond its plausible meaning to save the statute, end quote. This well could mean that if Judge Barrett is confirmed, Americans stand to lose the benefits that the ACA provides. So I hope you will clarify that in this hearing.
A little bit later today, Judge Barrett is expected to give her opening statement. Should that happen during our program, we'll bring at least part of that to you so you can hear her for a bit right here on Air Talk. I also want to remind you, if you want to listen to the entirety, the gavel-to-gavel coverage of day one of the confirmation hearing, visit NPR.org. That's NPR.org, and you can track the confirmation hearing in its entirety, gavel to gavel today. Joining us from Politico, Congressional Bureau Chief John Bresnahan will be talking with us about what's unfolded so far. John, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
One thing that seems very clear here is the big oral arguments on the Affordable Care Act that's coming up very soon. That's front and center for Democrats.
That is probably the top issue. All of the Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee have raised this issue during their opening statements that Judge Barrett is going, you know, under the Republican plan right now. Judge Barrett will be on the Supreme Court if she's, you know, if the Senate approves her by the time that the court hears oral arguments on the on Obamacare on November 10th. And, you know, they're all suggesting that she's there. You know, this is the Republican plan is to put her on the panel, and then they make sure they can strike down the Affordable Care Act, ACA. And that's something that the Democrats have been focusing on. That and abortion are probably the two biggest issues they've raised so far.
Let's dip in here. Kamala Harris, California senator and vice presidential candidate, speaking right now.
This committee is determined to rush a Supreme Court confirmation hearing through in just 16 days. Senate Republicans have made it crystal clear that rushing a Supreme Court nomination is more important than helping and supporting the American people who are suffering from a deadly pandemic and a devastating economic crisis. Their priorities are not the American people's priorities. But for the moment, Senate Republicans hold a majority in the Senate and determine the schedule. So here we are. The Constitution of the United States entrusts the Senate with the solemn duty to carefully consider nominations for lifetime appointments to the United States Supreme Court. Yet the Senate majority is rushing this process and jamming President Trump's nominee through the Senate while people are actually voting, just 22 days before the end of the election.
Senator Kamala Harris, both of California's senators are on the Senate Judiciary Committee, beginning with her remarks questioning the whole confirmation process of Judge Barrett for the Supreme Court. And she, as you could tell by the audio quality there, doing her opening statement remotely. Let me go back to John Bresnahan, Congressional Bureau Chief for Politico. John, Is this what we can expect, you think, throughout the course of the day, those two items, the ACA and abortion rights?
I think those will be the biggest issues, but there's a number of them. I think Democrats will raise issues, the allegation that President Trump is trying to jam this nomination through before the election, so Barrett's on the court to help him if the Supreme Court has to rule on any issues related to the election. This is a big concern of Democrats, like we had with Bush v. Gore in 2000, the Supreme Court could theoretically be involved in, if the election is thrown into court, if state elections are challenged by the Trump campaign, Trump-Pence campaign. So there's that issue. And I think there's just broad issues of Barrett is supposed to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was this heroic figure, I think, for both parties that across the country, this is icon. And the idea that, you would be pushing this nominee through closer than any, we'd have a Supreme Court vote closer to the election than any time in American history is just unprecedented. And I think Democrats from Senator Feinstein on down have questioned the legitimacy of this move.
John, the Republican Party has not come out with an alternative to the Affordable Care Act. Are Democrats considering that if the ACA ends up being declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, is there a plan B that the House is preparing that it'll have ready to go?
I think they definitely would work on something. I think you would see that pretty quickly. But again, this will depend on the outcome of the election. If President Trump is reelected, that's not going to happen. If the Republicans are in charge of the Senate, then it's not going to happen. I mean, you could see some legislation on pre-existing conditions, something narrow. Republicans try to move something on that to try and pick up Democrats. But again, this the future of the ACA, if it's struck down by the court, it depends wholly on who wins this election on November 3rd.
And John, before I let you go, what is the deadline here for the Senate to go through this process and bring it to a vote on the floor?
Well, the way it's going to work is we're going to have 4 days of hearings this week. And then the fourth day, they will try to move the nomination through the Senate Judiciary Committee. Under the committee rules, that can be delayed for a week. So the actual vote on Barrett in the committee will take place on October 22nd. And then at that point, they'll need a little time to process this and then bring it up on the floor. Now, there's nothing Democrats can do to stop the nomination from coming to the floor, but they can drag out the process for 3 days. You could have a nomination vote right at the end of October, where I would think right now it's kind of a little up in the air. They have to try and work it out, the two sides, the way the Senate works. They try to work these things out on consent, but there's no way the Democrats can stop it. They can just slow down the process. So I think right at the end of October is what we're looking at right now.
John Bresnahan of Politico, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Congressional Bureau Chief for Politico, John Bresnahan. Also with us is legal scholar from Santa Clara Law, Pradeepan Gulasekaram, professor of law, where he specializes in constitutional and immigration law. Professor Gulasekaram, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Larry.
Let's talk about what Democrats can potentially do here. They're going to bring up the ACA. That's a very, very clear strategy and make the case to Americans that they would be losing what's a popular health insurance program and concerns over the loss of abortion rights if Judge Barrett ends up being confirmed. What's your sense of the strength of those arguments in connecting with the electorate?
Well, I think that if you step back and think about the power of the Supreme Court, obviously they issue these rulings on constitutional matters that govern all of America, but the Supreme Court's power, its legitimacy comes just from that, what we as the American people, what we the people give to the Supreme Court as its power. And so I think that under these circumstances, I think that one of the things that people who are opposing this nomination, this confirmation, are doing is to say, listen, this is a very powerful institution. Judge Barrett, if confirmed, is 48 years old, will remain on the court for generations, and has the power over that time to really shape American constitutional law in ways that might significantly depart from what large majorities of the American public want. And so it's really a claim about legitimacy of the court overall.
On the ACA, what has Judge Barrett had to say about the Supreme Court's own ruling from a few years ago in which Chief Justice Roberts was the deciding vote allowing the ACA to stand?
Certainly in her academic writing from a few years ago, there's a sharp critique of what Chief Justice Roberts did in upholding the law. I think in it seems fairly clear that then Professor Barrett writing was making the claim that it was not reasonable, not okay for Chief Justice Roberts to have upheld the ACA on the basis that he did. There's a slightly different question that's being presented in the November 10th argument coming up in a case called Texas versus California, where the specific issue is going to be something called severability, and that is the question whether if one part of the law is found to be unlawful, does the entire law have to be declared unconstitutional? Now, given her past views on the ACA in general, perhaps it is right to believe that she would be likely to strike it down. On the other hand, it's not quite clear. I don't have a clear sense of how she feels on the more specific issue of severability.
Well, and what's your opinion, looking at the competing legal arguments there about severability? Do you think that the whole thing needs to fall as a result of the earlier decision or not?
No, I think in my view, and I think this is a fairly widely shared view, that just because one provision of the law is found to be unconstitutional, that the entirety of the law the rest of the law can still remain in effect. The Affordable Care Act is a large piece of legislation. It covers many different things, including community rating for insurance and several other provisions about pre-existing conditions. None of that necessarily depends on whether one part of it is found unconstitutional or not. In that sense, I think the lower court opinions that stretch to make that holding that the entire thing has to come down went well beyond what they should have done.
We're talking with Professor Deep Gulasekaram of Santa Clara Law, also joining us from South Texas College of Law in Houston, Professor Josh Blackman. He's a constitutional law and Supreme Court specialist. Professor, good to have you back with us again. Both of our guests have joined us in the past. Professor Blackman, we were just talking about on November 10th what's going to be in the oral arguments, Texas versus California. And do you think that it is possible to have the ACA stand even with the mandate removed?
Well, thank you for having me on. Just for disclosure, I filed what's called an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief, in support of the challengers in this case. I do think that the challenge has merit, but I do not think the entire statute must fall. The key question is, under current doctrine, can you sever or can you cut off part of the law? And I think even under the more conservative approaches to the court's jurisprudence, the law can survive in the absence of the mandate. I think other things might happen short of killing the entire law, but I think the notion that the entire ACA will be set aside is simply fear-mongering. I think people want to say it to try to attack Judge Barrett, but I don't see that as a plausible outcome in line where the court is right now.
Professor Gulasekaram, you disagree?
No, I don't necessarily disagree with trying to read the tea leaves on the question of severability. There have been several justices who've expressed already on the court who've expressed skepticism about the idea of reading severability in a way that would allow for invalidation of large pieces of legislation. The court tends to be a little more scrupulous about going about it. So in that sense, you know, I don't disagree, but I think I disagree with the general premise that I think that there's a reason Judge Barrett is being nominated, or the type of people who President Trump would nominate are being nominated, and I think partly it is hopefully on the part of the GOP that they would be reliable votes to strike down things like the ACA and other types of large national interventions.
One of the things I was curious about is sort of with what other justice Judge Barrett would be most aligned in. You know, we have in John Roberts someone who's been described, I think, as an institutionalist. And where, Professor Blackmun, would you see a Justice Barrett standing related to her peers?
Well, Judge Barrett, almost Justice Barrett, clerk for Justice Scalia, and she said that Justice Scalia's philosophy is her own, that she is an originalist. I think she will fall somewhere closer to Justice Scalia would in terms of these sort of constitutional issues. I don't know if maybe she might be perhaps closer to Justice Kavanaugh or Justice Gorsuch. I think she's probably to their right. Both Justices Kavanaugh and Gorsuch have surprised a bit. They have not been clones of the president that appointed them, not by any stretch of the imagination. They've been somewhat disappointments in some regards. I think Justice Barrett would be less of a disappointment for conservatives than are Kavanaugh and Gorsuch.
What about the position that the court is going to have if we have a contested election and it comes down to a decision of the court as to which ballots are counted and ultimately who is the next president? If she is confirmed and is sitting on that court, you have any sense of where, you know, her view of how the court would work through that?
Well, with election cases, you have to keep in mind there are two possible disputes. One is which the state courts or the lower courts try to intervene and they don't. And the other one is where the state courts do not intervene and the Supreme Court does. In the Florida 2000 case, the Florida Supreme Court was engaging in some questionable rulings about counting some ballots and not others. Whether the Supreme Court could review those cases is a totally separate question. But what we're seeing now is that a number of courts are extending deadlines or making it easier to drop off ballots. They're relaxing requirements. And consistently, the five members of the Roberts Court have simply said, no, you can't do this. We're so close to the election, you can't change the rules. If Justice Barrett participates, I think we'll see a similar trend where the Supreme Court says, we're not going to allow courts to make it easier to vote during the COVID pandemic. I think that means more stringent, more rigid rules. There are calls for her to recuse. I don't want to minimize those. Some people think that the mere fact that Trump appointed her means she's recused, has to step down. I'm a bit skeptical. Once you're on the court, you have life tenure. She owes Donald Trump nothing. I know people think she does, but I don't think she holds any water for him anymore. But there will be calls for her to recuse without question.
And we'll hear what Professor Gulasekaram has to say about that. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Again, if you want to hear the gavel-to-gavel coverage of the Senate Judiciary Committee confirmation hearing day one, that's available at npr.org. We'll continue our conversation with our legal scholars back in 1 minute. So good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Next hour, we celebrate together the Lakers' 17th NBA championship that ties them with our rival, the Celtics, for the most in NBA history. Remarkable run under very challenging circumstances for LeBron James, Anthony Davis, and their teammates. That's coming up next hour on Air Talk. If you have questions about the confirmation process or any of the issues expected to be the contentious ones before the U.S. Supreme Court this term, you can give a call and ask your question at 866-893-KPECC. This is not so much for you to, you know, share your opinion about whether there should be a confirmation hearing or whether the Republican majority Senate should be following through with this, but any questions about the process, about Judge Barrett, about the implications of her potential confirmation, 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. I'm joined by South Texas College of Law Professor Josh Blackmun and Santa Clara Law Professor Deep Gulasekaram, 866-893-KPECC. I did want to get Professor Gulasekaram, your thoughts on the same issue we had just been talking about with Josh Blackmun before the break.
Sure. So first, let me say, Larry, as a native Angeleno, I'm excited for your next hour.
Very good.
But before getting there, I think this your question to Josh about recusal and a potential Justice Barrett on the court when the if the outcome of the election is in question is exactly what makes this nomination at this moment so fraught. I think questions about her qualifications to become a Supreme Court justice are mostly beside the point. By all accounts, she's a well-published scholar, did extremely well in school, and there's not really that question. The question is more about her taking the nomination under these circumstances. Whether we like it or not, Bush versus Gore turned out to be five right-leaning justices deciding the election in favor of George W. Bush, and I think that there is clearly that concern that might arise right now when people are already voting at the same time that you have a nomination in which the president of the United States running for re-election has refused to signal that he would be amenable to a peaceful transition of power if he were to lose the election. So I think those are the circumstances that make this such a fraught nomination and her position at this point one that seriously threatens the question of Supreme Court legitimacy.
Well, indeed, I think, what if when the news organizations did the final count of Florida in that Bush versus Gore election, and Al Gore would have won Florida, and that would have determined, and then you had that Supreme Court decision sitting there. What do you think that would have done in terms of the reputation of the court?
Well, I think if we look back to 2000 when those events were happening, I think the court did take, it's hard to say how it longitudinally over time, whether there was any significant diminution of how we thought of the court. But I think at that time, I think the clear signal was that the court is extremely political and is one in which the exercise of raw political power might work in the same way as it does in the Senate and the House and other elected bodies. I think we as the American public don't want to think of the court in that way. We want to think about it as above that fray, but I think 2000 demonstrated that the court is in fact a part of that fray.
We're talking with professor from Santa Clara Law, Deep Gulasekaram, and Josh Blackmun from South Texas College of Law in Houston. Renee asks, didn't the Supreme Court strike down a key provision of the Voting Rights Act without overturning the entire law? That law was severable. That's Renee. Professor Blackmun.
That's right. The case was called Shelby County Beholder. The Voting Rights Act is a huge piece of legislation that ensures there's protection for people to vote without regard to race. The court declared part of the law unconstitutional, what's called the coverage formulas. This was a part of the law that said these states and these jurisdictions are subject to scrutiny by the federal government and the courts, and other states are subject to less scrutiny. The court simply said you can't have those maps. Those maps are based on an outdated approach to race. You need to make new maps. Congress has never actually made these new maps. But you can still have states that engage in intentional discrimination to be punished. So again, I really think that this I'm watching this hearing, this senator after senator saying they're going to destroy the entire ACA. I don't think Texas actually believes it's going to happen. I think if you actually ask the Texas Attorney General, do you think this will happen? He'll tell you privately, no. The timing of this could not have been worse in light of the Barrett hearing, but I do think this is mostly a way to avoid talking about Judge Barrett's qualifications, which they don't have much to challenge on. So they need something to talk about, and this is the point they've decided to talk about.
Josh, where what is legitimate about her personal views to talk about here? There's discussion about her Catholicism. She's obviously a very committed person of faith. But, Joe Biden is a devout Catholic and has views that are different in some respects, some areas from his church, and has said when it comes to policies that his faith does not dictate what he advocates for. Is that the kind of thing you anticipate, Professor, that Democrats will try and get to with Judge Barrett?
Our Constitution has a provision that says no religious tests for certain offices. And I think that's a good thing. We shouldn't ask people to pass a certain religious test. And I think there's an unfortunate bias towards people of faith. They think that their faith blinds them, that because if you're a Catholic or a Jew or whatever else, that you have to do whatever your rabbi or priest tells you. And this is something, a question that secular people just will not get. If someone's a partisan, a liberal or conservative, they also have their strong philosophical commitments. I don't think religion is any stronger or weaker than how some people approach politics with fervor. So I don't expect we'll see these questions. Perhaps you could ask a question, will you be able to decide a case separate from your beliefs, whether they're religious or political? The answer to the question is going to be yes. And I think that's about where those questions should stop.
Okay. What do you think, Professor Gulasekaram? How would you get at that issue if you were a senator questioning her?
Well, I think that the way I would get at it is that currently the court is being faced with and will continue to be faced with questions in which justices are going to have to decide clashes between the rights of sexual minorities and general anti-discrimination provisions. And here, I think, is one of the areas of conflict that where one's own view of religion and how much religion should be allowed in the public sphere in commercial transactions makes a difference. Because if we're asking the question whether a baker, for example, can refuse service to a same-sex couple, or a case coming before the court this term, Fulton versus Philadelphia, where the question is whether the Catholic Church can refuse to do foster services or can...
I think we just lost Professor Gulasekaram's line there. I'm sure we'll hear back from him and reconnect momentarily. Again, if you have questions for our legal scholars, that's Professor Deep Gulasekaram of Santa Clara Law, Josh Blackman, South Texas College of Law in Houston. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. That's a very broad question, Professor Blackman, but... As you've studied different justices or elected officials over the years, what are the different ways that people work through their very strong religious beliefs and either have them reflected or not? And what seems to be the difference maker as to whether it is consistent with their religious view, what they advocate in policy, versus they have carve-outs in that?
Thanks. You know, I think it's a mistake to focus just on religion. And I'll give you an example. Let's say you have a gay judge and he's deciding a case involving gay marriage. Does the judge have to recuse? Or if you have a black judge deciding a case involving affirmative action, does a black judge have to recuse? Those questions are not asked. But when it involves religion, it's like, oh, they have to recuse. People have aspects of their personal life that affect how they judge. And I think we ought to be candid about that. But we put someone on the bench because of their integrity and their ability to set their own personal beliefs aside. And I think that should apply to whether it's a gay judge on a case involving gay rights or a black judge involving affirmative action or a religious judge in a case involving, you know, religious freedom. I think we have judges with integrity. If there's reason to believe that Judge Barrett's a hack and that she can't set aside her prejudices, then she shouldn't be on the she shouldn't be on the bench. But once we get past that threshold issue, I think religion issue is just a smokescreen, it's a distraction.
Along the lines of what you're talking about, I think back to when President Trump questioned the fairness of a judge that was taking on one of his cases because the judge was Latino, and how pernicious that comment was.
Yeah, Judge Curiel down in San Diego, that's exactly right. He said, I think he was actually born in Indiana, if my memory serves. You can just Google me on that one. But I think he was born in somewhere in the Midwest, but he was of Mexican heritage. And Judge President Trump said he can't be trusted to decide a case on immigration, a case involving Trump because of immigration context. And I think it's a ridiculous comment. I think if you're a judge and you make it to that level, you're expected to be a man or woman of integrity. And that's the question. Are you a person of integrity? If you are, then we trust your judgment. If we think we'll let your political or philosophical or ideological views sway you, then you have no place in the robe.
I think we have Professor Gulasekaram back. Sorry, we lost the connection there with you. And you were in mid-thought if you want to pick up what you were just saying.
Thank you, Larry. I'm not sure if where I stopped, but I was just going to point out that there is a case, Fulton versus Philadelphia, in front of the court this term, in which these questions of religious exemptions against anti-discrimination, general anti-discrimination norms are going to be presented. And I think we'll continue to see those sorts of claims. I generally agree with what Josh was just saying about the nature of the person taking the robe. But I do think it's fair to wonder how a justice will mediate between two very fundamental constitutional concerns, the concern for religious practice, but on the other hand, a very strong constitutional drive towards equality norms and making sure vulnerable populations are protected.
Well, and I was trying to think if there's an example. You had a law professor who focused on environmental law, perhaps, and as a part of that was someone who was very pro-environmental, pro-restrictions to protect the environment and all, and ended up nominated for a judgeship. Wouldn't it be appropriate, Professor Blackmun, to ask her or him, given the way in which they had characterized the law involving environmental issues, would they be able to, fairly decide those kinds of cases?
Yeah, I think their scholarship is fair game. I think that's different than religion, because scholarship is something where you discuss how you approach the law. And I think Judge Barrett should be asked about those opinions. Look, you're going to have some judges and some professors who approach the law differently. And that's why the president picks one over the other. Right. A judge that might appeal to Barack Obama's political philosophy would not appeal to President Trump's political philosophy, and vice versa. I think when you win an election, you get the right to pick a judge who's more conducive to you. What I would stress, though, is that judges are not robots. They don't behave in a predictable fashion. In fact, they often behave in an unpredictable fashion, especially Republican justices. Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, John Roberts, David Souter, Sandra Day O'Connor, Anthony Kennedy. I can go back. In fact, it's more likely than not that Justice Barrett will disappoint conservatives than not. The Democratic justices tend to fall in line more often than not. But I think just you roll the dice with a conservative judge. You don't ever really know what you're going to get. It's like a box of chocolates, you might say.
All right, gentlemen, thank you. I appreciate your being with us. That's Josh Blackmun, professor, South Texas College of Law in Houston, and Deep Gulasekaram, professor at Santa Clara Law in Northern California, and, like most of us, a Laker fan himself. And coming up next hour, we celebrate that big Laker victory in Game 6 of the NBA Championship against the Miami Heat last night. The Heat have some impressive players, too. Jimmy Butler, amazing. Big, big accomplishment for the Lakers, and we'll celebrate by opening up the phones next hour here on Air Talk. But first, we're going to open up the phones coming up to how are you talking about the November election with friends and family members? We've talked a lot about divisiveness around President Trump or disagreement on Joe Biden versus Trump. I'm curious about other aspects of the ballot. We've got a big head-to-head district attorney's race with two very different candidates in Los Angeles County. We've got all kinds of statewide ballot measures that polling shows are running neck and neck. So are you talking with your friends and family about all these other things on the ballot, or shying away because of polarization in our world today? 866-893-KPECC. It's just you and me, and I want to hear from you coming right up.